Their producers have given us special permission to use these clips in our worship services, and we're thankful for them because they give us such incredible insights to the scriptures. And if you haven't been watching The Chosen, it's available on app, on YouTube. I've heard it's available in other ways as well. It's an incredible series that we're enjoying. And we're also enjoying this morning the special presence of a couple that's visiting us again, Dominic and Jackie Ferrone. Would you guys stand, our former youth pastors in this place? It's great to have y'all with us. And I lost count, 4 or 5 kids and 1 on the way. Yeah. I'm not going to make any jokes about that. I'm going to leave that alone. What an incredible scene that we just saw. What if all that I thought was true, what if it's wrong? What if it's wrong? Matthew in that scene has come to a place of crisis. Lee Strobel asked the same question. What if everything I thought was right is wrong? He was a journalist at the time for the Chicago Tribune, trained at Yale Law School. He was an atheist or an agnostic at best. He was a person that prided himself on following the evidence and getting the story right. And he thought he did have it right, especially in the case of James Dixon. I've told some of you that story before. It's fascinating to me. A police sergeant, Richard Scanlon, had been shot in the stomach while scuffling with a perpetrator who was a domestic call. He went out, he found him rapping on the door with his gun, the others inside, the father and his girlfriend inside, fearful for their lives. And as he approached him, they scuffled and the gun went off and he was shot in the belly. And by the time the paramedics got there, apparently the gun had been thrown in the bushes, but he was detained. And it seemed to be a slam dunk case. His fingerprints were on the gun, James Dixon's, a .22 caliber. There were powder stains on the stomach of the officer, powder burns. He had been shot at close range, just as eyewitnesses would testify, the father of the girlfriend that had joined them on the porch before the scuffle broke out. Scanlon's gun was still holstered and strapped down at the time that the paramedics were working on them. He hadn't drawn his gun. And even Dixon confessed before the trial was to begin that he had shot the man. And he was sentenced. A plea bargain. An unintentional shooting. He plea bargained out to just a year. But then more evidence surfaced. Lee Strobel was the journalist that got the call that Scanlon had been bragging at a cop's party a couple of weeks before about a special gun he was carrying. It was called a pin gun. It's a .22 caliber pistol that's made to look like an ink pen. He said to Strobel, "It's not what it seems. Look into it." And as a journalist, he began to probe the facts. He began to look deeper into what was going on. The powder burns that were on the belly of the officer when he examined the shirt were inside the shirt pocket, but not outside. That had not been noticed before. Scanlon's silence about the fact, the way he kept his story so much to himself, he obviously preferred the medal of bravery that was pinned to his chest weeks later rather than the consequences of having confessed he was carrying an illegal gun. Once the news got out, he was stripped of his job with the police department. James Dixon's confession, it was a plea bargain. He had already served 362 days in jail. And if he confessed to the crime, he would have been released in 3 days. So he confessed. And he got out early. In just 3 days, if he had gone to trial, he risked perhaps a 20-year sentence. It only made sense to him to plead guilty even though he was innocent. And then Lee Strobel writes this. In the end, Dixon was exonerated, and he later won a lawsuit against the police department. Scanlon was stripped of his medal, was indicted by a grand jury, pleaded guilty to official misconduct, and was fired from the department. As for me, my stories were splashed across the front page. Much more important, I learned some big lessons as a young reporter. One of the most obvious lessons was that evidence can be a line to point in more than one direction. For example, there had easily been enough proof to convict Dixon of shooting the sergeant, but the key questions were these. Had the collection of evidence really been thorough? And which explanation best fit the totality of the facts? Matthew became, in a sense, the reporter of the disciples. He would write down things that others would not. We know this from the early church fathers that told us that he wrote a book of Jesus' saying called The Oracles of the Lord, which preceded the Gospels. It's lost to us today. But Matthew, like Lee Strobel, became a guy that was consumed with knowing the facts. He had an incredible mind, calculating. He was a gifted person, obviously, from the details that he takes down in Scripture, and as he's depicted in The Chosen as someone who has Asperger's or is autistic, on the autistic scale somewhere. Oftentimes when people have those kinds of circumstances affecting their personality, they also have extraordinary abilities, particularly with numbers or with music or with other things. They paint him as a person with that kind of personality, and that's not inconsistent with the Matthew that we know from the Scriptures. It may be the most precise reading of what he was really like. And Matthew is taking in some new information that's turning his world upside down. What he thought he knew before, he now questions. He's witnessed things that he can't explain. The big catch with the fishermen. How did Jesus make those fish appear? Peter tries to talk him out of having observed that. You didn't see that. You didn't see him, he says. And Matthew says, no, I saw him. Risking getting a pelting, you know. He will not let go of the truth. That's the kind of guy he is. No, I saw him. Are you saying I'm deceived? The Chosen shows him actually as a witness to the young man who was raised from his paralytic bed that had been left down through the roof there in Capernaum. That's possible. Matthew was a tax collector in the same little community where all those things had happened, where the fish had been caught, where the paralytic had gotten up to walk. And it's depicted in The Chosen, not in the Bible, but in The Chosen, it imagines Matthew coming down from his perch where he's observed all this, completely baffled by what he's seen. And the little children ask him a question. Sir, are you lost? Do you remember that scene? And Matthew says, yes, I am. I'm lost. I had the world figured out. I had the world by the tail. I saw the best game in town for making money, and I seized it. Why shouldn't you? I had all the gifts that were necessary to be a tax collector for the Romans. I'm a practical guy. I weigh, I evaluate things. People pass through my tax collector's booth or through my trade booth, and I have to evaluate things in a moment. The figures just come to my mind. I can tell if that's worth that, is worth more than that. I'm constantly evaluating. I do it all day. It's what I love. It's who I am. And I had it all figured out, but now I'm not so sure. Give Matthew some credit in the story that we'll read this morning of his conversion. In one verse, he both meets Jesus. Jesus asks him to follow him, and he leaves everything and follows him. That sounds almost crazy to me. I'd wonder about somebody who made that kind of snap decision. I'd question my kids if they made a decision that quickly that affected their futures that drastically. You would too. Don't look at me that way. You would too. At least Matthew was decisive. Jesus said, "Follow me." What did he do? He analyzed it in a moment. His evaluation savvy mind calculated, and he came to his verdict. Like a juror in a trial, that's their responsibility, that they would come to a verdict based on the evidence. Have you done that with regard to Jesus? Because he says to you, as he says to Matthew, "Follow me." I wonder if your verdict is as decisive as it's depicted here of Matthew. Let's watch this next clip.
You see the Parthian foot races last night? Darius ran like a gazelle.
Jews don't go to foot races.
Your old friend Simon himself used to run the wagering tables.
We're not friends. Next.
Okay, fine. So you did not go to the races. You stay home?
I went to see my mother.
That would put me out, too. She asked when you're going to give her grandchildren?
She didn't ask.
I thought your parents don't speak to you.
I had questions I couldn't ask anyone else.
A mother of a son with talent like yours should be proud.
She's ashamed that I could use a talent that God gave me against God. Next.
You're good at something. You found a way to make a living doing it. It's that simple.
Must be nice to live in a world so simply ordered.
We live in the same world, Matthew.
Next.
Besides, what else are you going to do with a mind like yours?
Matthew. Matthew, son of Alphaeus.
Yes.
Follow me.
Me?
Yes, you.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What are you doing? You want me to join you?
Keep moving, street preacher.
Do you have any idea what this guy has done? Do you even know him? Yes.
Listen, I said to... What are you doing? Where do you think you're going?
Guys, let me go.
Have you lost your mind? You have money. Quintus protects you. No Jew lives as good as you. You're going to throw it all away.
Yes. I don't get it.
You didn't get it when I chose you either.
But this is different. I'm not a tax collector.
Get used to different.
I'm glad we passed by your booth today, Matthew.
Yes.
Shall we? We have a celebration to prepare for.
You will regret this, Matthew.
What's the tablet for?
I grabbed it without thinking. You can put it back.
No, keep it. You may yet find use for it.
Where are we going?
A dinner party.
I'm not welcome at dinner parties.
Well, that's not going to be a problem tonight. You're the host.
How many lives do we know that are stuck because the state, because of what Paul says in his letter, always learning but never coming to the knowledge of the truth. Some of us by nature are indecisive, but that wasn't Matthew's problem. He had some, but that wasn't it. If Christ demands a verdict of us, he was ready to give it. And without that kind of decisiveness in our own lives, destinies don't unfold to us. Doors don't open with us. Plans that God has for us go on the stall. Matthew's the only one that records these parables of Jesus. They're what I would call the wise trader parables. There are two of them. They're nowhere else in all of Scripture. But Matthew would understand these. He was an evaluator. He was a businessman. In verse 44 of chapter 13, he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid, and from joy over it, he goes and he sells all that he has, and he buys that field." That was Matthew's story. The very next verse, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls, an evaluator, someone who knows the value of things, a merchant, a trained eye, seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and he sold all that he had and he bought it. Now, you might expect, if you know me very well, or if you've heard me preach, as many tears flow from my eyes when I'm in touch with this deeper truth. You might think that in order to be a Christian, you have to be an emotional person. That if anybody follows Jesus, it's just because they've got emotionally worked up and are doing something impulsive. But that's not the case with this guy. He is coldly calculating. And he adds up the pros and cons of this decision, and he is immediately decisive. Give him the chance, he's going to leave it all behind. He's found his pearl of great price. He's going to follow Jesus. You got to hand it to Matthew. With all the things that might have been strange about this fella, indecisiveness was not his problem. He could evaluate things and make quick decisions. But not only was he decisive, which I think is a great strength, Matthew was also venturous. Let me unpack that for a while. He was not just decisive. He was also a person that was given, he was willing to take a risk, willing to become a tax collector, willing to follow Jesus, willing to lay it all on the line. Notice that when he left the booth, the way they depict it there, he mindlessly picks up his tool, his pen and his pad, right? He was a man that would meticulously, especially if he was of that OCD nature, right? meticulously take down facts. He picks up his notebook and his pen, and he repurposes those things that used to rob his people as being the tools by which he would give them the greatest gift that they could ever receive, knowledge of the gospel and knowledge of his Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He repurposed them in God's agenda, where they had previously served him only in his agenda. I wonder if you have gifts, if you have abilities, and maybe they've served you well in the past, if your friends that know you best, what would they say about you as being your strengths? And let me ask you, if you've done what Matthew did and somehow repurposed those strengths, those tools, for kingdom purposes, if you will, you'll know more lasting benefits from that wise trade. Let me see if I can get through this quickly. We know that Mark's gospel was probably written first. It's the shortest of the gospels, 600 verses versus 1,000 or 1,200 in Luke or in Matthew. But we know that Luke and Matthew used the timeline, the event signature, pretty much, of Mark. They both used that as kind of the unfolding of the story. But they've added to it, what they added that Mark left out is Mark was this young guy. He tells Jesus' story like it's a Marvel comic. It's all what Jesus did. And Jesus is his superhero. And immediately Jesus went and prayed. And immediately. Jesus is almost, you can almost see the cape and the little feathers on his ankles. You know, that's Mark. But then Matthew and Luke add stuff to that gospel. Same kind of timeline, but what they add is the teachings, especially Matthew. And what most scholars believe is those teachings, because much of what Matthew and Luke add as the teachings are almost verbatim, word for word. It's as if they're using a common source, and many of those scholars have called that source Q. They were German scholars, and their word for source in German is Quelle. So they call it Q. I don't know why. That's the stuff scholars do, just to make it difficult. So everybody will wonder, what's Q about? Okay? So, but Kel, that original source, is thought to be the sayings of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus. And if you look in church history, Eusebius tells about a man named Papias who lived about 100 AD, and he quotes him. We don't have any of those writings. Those have been lost. But because Eusebius quotes him, years and years later, we know what he said when he saw what he said. And he said that Matthew was one who wrote a work called The Oracles of the Lord. The Oracles of the Lord, the sayings of Jesus. And some of those grand scholars don't even believe that Matthew the apostle was the one that wrote Matthew the gospel. I'm not ready to make that conclusion yet. But they do say that Matthew had to be the one that wrote that kind of sayings of Jesus in a reporter-like recorded form. And if you read Matthew, you get to like Matthew 13, and it's the kingdom is like, the kingdom is like, and it's one saying, one parable, one proverb, one right after the other, just almost as if they've been taken off a list somewhere. You ever read Matthew and noticed that? So Matthew took his pen that had been used to cheat the Jews of more taxes by which he himself got rich, right? And he repurposed his pen for the purpose of blessing all of us, especially blessing the Jews. It's said that that first gospel of Matthew was the only one of the gospels that was first written in Aramaic, the common tongue of those in that day that Matthew had swindled in the town of Capernaum. He was venturous. You've seen other people do that from time to time, take their particular gift and apply it in a way that blesses the kingdom. And you don't have to do it perfectly, but there's something about using your strength with a godly agenda that almost always pays incredible fruit. It's like you've stepped into that place for which you were meant to be. I've often wondered if Mel Gibson's whole career was just to set him up to make The Passion of the Christ. I wonder if Elvis and Carrie Underwood's career was all for the sake of those gospel albums. I've wondered if Bush and Trump led with their leadership because of a different kind of calling, a different kind of drawing, a different kind of way to express that. I've wondered if Josh McDowell presented evidence as an apologist because he had the strengths of presenting evidence as a lawyer. How can you repurpose the gifts that God has given you to make a difference for other people and for God's sake? He was venturous with his gifts, but also Matthew was venturous with his relationships. He took his pen and he asked, what can I bring to the kingdom through this? And he looked around at his relationships and he said, who can I bring? And immediately following this calling of Matthew in chapter 9 of Matthew, as he records it, immediately following that, Matthew throws a party. And I want you to pay a special attention to the guest list. And Jesus passed on from there, and he saw a man called Matthew sitting in his tax office, and he said to him, follow me. And he rose and he followed him. Decisive. And it happened that as he was reclining at table in the house, we know from Luke that it was Matthew's house, that Jesus was reclining at table in the house, behold, many tax gatherers and sinners came and joined Jesus and his disciples at the table. Matthew was the host. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax gatherers and sinners? Notice who they asked that of. The disciples. Notice who answers. And when he heard this, he said, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are ill. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Matthew risked a venture that most of us think of ourselves as too sophisticated to venture. We know better. We know at every wedding reception there are those who leave early and those who stay late. And it's usually only those kind of occasions that get those two crowds together. The others are not invited to the others' parties. Oh, look at me like I'm saying something crazy this morning. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? The rascals and the religious rarely hang out together. But that doesn't seem to be the case with Jesus. He drew rascals as magnetically as he drew anybody else. In fact, often he would repel religious people. And so Jesus apparently is not available to these religious people who are obviously not getting involved in this. Thank you very much. And what is up with your master that he would eat and drink and share fellowship with these notorious sinners over here? And the disciples look at one another because they had grown up in the same town and they knew how to play by the same rules and they didn't say anything. I venture because they didn't have an answer. And can you imagine Matthew at that moment? Oh my gosh, I'm new to this stuff. I hadn't been to synagogue in the last 10 years since I became a tax collector. And boy, I've messed up. I've destroyed Jesus' reputation. These religious people are now going to judge him. It's all going to go to heck in a handbasket before you know it. And it's all my fault. Oh my gosh, what is going to happen here? And Jesus speaks up. He says, what would you have us do? The physician belongs with those who are sick, not those who are well. I've come to call sinners. Can you imagine Matthew going, whew, I didn't mess up. I didn't mess up. It actually pleases him. And then he turns to the Pharisees as he's politely telling them to get their tails out of there. I love this about Jesus. Go then and learn what it means. He was strong. Go then and learn what it means. I desire compassion more than sacrifice. It's you that has something to learn here. You righteous, judgmental ones. Go and learn what it means. I desire compassion, not sacrifice. You see, Jesus had a heart that was touched by God's heart. They beat as one. And so Jesus was doing what the sheep do in that parable. He was showing compassion towards these people. But the Pharisees didn't get it because their understanding of righteousness was being set apart to God, but not being set apart for God to use in God's way, according to God's heart, at least as they had interpreted it. And so for them, sacrifice made them self-righteous. But Jesus wasn't using someone else as a sacrifice. He had a heart that was already ready to be sacrificial, to sacrifice himself. He had so much of the heart of God in him that he wasn't concerned about how people saw him as righteous enough. He wasn't concerned about how he appeared. He was more concerned about what he was, being righteous, not looking righteous. And so he was freed up to act with compassion, whatever others' judgments might be of him. I love that about Jesus. If Jesus had been one of those self-righteous ones, he would have been rightfully so. He could have been. He was righteous. But that wasn't the game he was playing. That wasn't the music that he was dancing to. He knew the heart of God, and he was compassionate for people. He did it without sin. But he did it with abandon. They said of him that he was a man who ate and drank with tax collectors and sinners. And I would love for us to be that kind of church. And I see so many signs that we are that kind of church that values Matthew parties. Where people who know Jesus and people who don't know Jesus can rub shoulders with one another and see what happens. And I trust in those moments that those who do know Jesus have become righteous enough in who they are and in whose they are that they will not be changed by the sinners that they encounter or the sin with which they're involved. That they won't be influenced, they'll be influencers because they've already been influenced by the heart of God. Do you follow me? There's a protection that goes with that kind of heart that's been sanctified with that kind of fiery compassion and love for people. You can walk into a coal mine with a white dress on and still come out unmarked. When you've had that kind of heart baptism, that kind of heart compassion within you, and I love to be a part of a church that dares to do things like pickleball. Pickleball. What's a church doing pickleball? I'll tell you what we're doing. It's a Matthew party. It's a Matthew party 3 days a week, and if you want to learn how, you can come Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 to noon and learn how to be a part of this particular Matthew party. And the truth of the matter is we need more of us rubbing shoulders with folks who may or may not know Jesus who are just pickleball fans. But 30 or 40 of them come here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. And if we could be in there, as many of us are, rubbing elbows with those kind of folks, my hunch is that the Jesus contagion would take. That they, like others who knew authentic followers of Christ, would say, "What is wrong with you people? All the other gyms in town make us pay fees to come and play pickleball, and that makes sense. What do you get out of this? Don't you wish somebody would ask you that question while you're playing pickleball? Well, what I get is a relationship with you. What I get is a chance to know you. Oh, but do you really know who he is? Yes. He might be the next child of God. That's who he is. That's who she is. Matthew parties. They happen here within our church. I thank God for pickleball, because it's a lot more than pickleball. It's a place where people's lives, and we've had people become members of our church, come to know Christ because of the ministry that goes there. Some of you may know that every Thursday night in our church, though it's not necessarily a ministry of our church, we host it every Thursday night. Are you aware that almost 200 men gather in our gym every Thursday night? 200 men from all over this city. It's called Band of Brothers, and some of us participate in it. There's a wave in the fall and a wave in the spring, and what that means is there's 12 weeks, a session each Thursday night where you can bring your fellows, other men that would not necessarily be comfortable in a church service, but they'll be comfortable in a gym, right? Just like all of Matthew's friends would not have been comfortable or allowed in synagogue, but they're okay at Matthew's house. Are you with me? And so they come every Thursday night, and they do manly things. They grunt and yell and stuff like that. Scared me the first time I went. One guy said, "Hoy, we're here." You know, I thought, who is that drill sergeant? And before I could turn around to figure out who that was, the whole crowd said, "What? Hut?" See, there you go. There's one of them right there. "So others may live." I went, "What was that?" "So others may live." Sounds like a bunch of Green Berets, and they are for Jesus. Yeah. And they take their buddies there that would never darken the door of a church service, and they're caught up in drugs, and they're spinning off into all kinds of destruction in their lives, but they come through those doors, and they have guys that look them face to face and say, "No, Jesus can change your life. Change your life." The first night I was there, they rammed up the whole place. The whole gym was encircled with men. And one guy in the middle said, "Step into the circle if you're an OSU fan." And, you know, we know in Oklahoma sometimes that takes a little bit of courage. And so we stepped into the circle, and it was about half of us. And we stepped back, and they gave OU the same chance. And then they started asking tougher questions. "How many of you have been through a divorce before?" And I stepped into that circle, and I looked around, and the guy in the middle said, "You're not alone." And I saw in an instant all those other guys that had been through that same thing. They stepped back from the circle. They asked all kinds of questions of that. "How many of you have been incarcerated before?" Half the room stepped into the circle. I went, "Oh, Lord." Not really. I was already trusting the hearts of these guys around me. They were being honest with each other and honest with the Lord. I heard testimonies of a guy who had been in the last wave that had come because his marriage was falling apart, and he was hopelessly addicted to alcohol, and he came to those first meetings, and he's been sober ever since. And as he gave his testimony for what God had done in his life, one of his old drinking buddies that he didn't know was there was on the outside of that circle and stepped into it and said, "I need that too." Folks, that's gospel. That's authentic Christianity still making a difference in this world. And I thank God that it happens in this church. I could tell story after story, but so many of those stories have to do with the fact that this church still takes risks with Matthew parties. In our home teams, hopefully there's times that even when we're not doing our Bible study, and we're just doing a barbecue, and inviting our other friends who may not be comfortable at a Bible study but would be comfortable at a barbecue. Who in Oklahoma is not comfortable at a barbecue? It's almost like it's part of our DNA, right? And so we can get to know people and realize that they're not that much different than us, and maybe we do have something in common, and And home teams can throw a Matthew party that gives someone else the ability to step in. Unleashed, we're at the dog parks meeting all kinds of people as we carry on conversations with our puppies. And the truth of the matter of fact is people are making connections. It's just friendship. That's all it is. It's people being friends to another, just as Jesus was a friend to Matthew, and Matthew was a friend to all those that were in his house that day. And how many of those came to know Christ? I wonder if Zacchaeus, the wee little man that was up in a tree, who was also a tax collector, had been at that party that day. So that's really the questions this morning. If you want an application as you walk out the door, let's be as Matthew was. Let's be decisive. Let's be venturous, not only with the gifts that we have to offer to God in service to Him, but also with our relationships, both those that we have and those that we can make. Not only ask what can we employ for God, but ask who we can bring to God. And to get with Jesus in our own heart until our heart is so on fire with compassion, so excited to be following Him, So given to His heart and the way He feels about others, that if He tells us to throw a party, we're ready for it. That's okay, Jesus might say. You're going to be the host. Matthew, help us to learn from You. Help us to be more like You. Because in so many ways, You were like our Lord. And Father, help us to see in one another that touch of You that inspires us to grow even deeper. That You're with each of us. That You're expressing Yourself through all of us in our own particular uniqueness. Our own personalities, as quirky as they may be, You use us. Our own gifts, as different as they may be, You employ us. Our relationships, as varied and as diverse as they are, Father, You long for every single person on the other end of that connection to know You, to know Your redemption, to know Your love, to know Your life-changing touch, to know Your fellowship. And God, You give us the opportunity to be the link. Thank You, Jesus.